I think it was really great advice because I felt like things started coming together after that because I could talk really confidently and speak really confidently about the things I was good at versus trying to just be this other person.
Hey, Bomb Squad, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, the show that's all about women and food. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond, coming to you from Brooklyn, New York. We have a bonus episode for you today, and this one is all about startups. Startups come in all shapes and sizes, but they are similar in that they take a lot of grit and tenacity to get them off the ground. Despite all the love and hard work that goes into startups, about 90% of them fail. Oof. That is such a painful stat. Still, that did not deter today's guests, Crystal Mobieni of Bento Box and Julia Joseph of Maple Hill Creamery. Their companies went from startups to success, and they are here to tell us about everything from the bumps to the triumphs. Speaking of startups, later on during the break, we're going to hear how a certain Silicon Valley startup came to be, and it's not what you expect. Stay tuned for a special excerpt from There Was Cheese Parked in Adina Sussman's Garage. That's a great title, right? It's the latest episode of Schmaltzy, the podcast from the Jewish Food Society. You can listen to Schmaltzy wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you to Schmaltzy for being our partner on today's episode. First up is Crystal Mobieni of Bento Box. If you work in the restaurant industry or spend time on restaurant websites, you might know the name Bento Box, the tech company that describes itself as a restaurant's digital storefront. They help with websites, online ordering, gift cards, event management, and a lot more. During the pandemic, Bento Box was a lifesaver for many establishments. Co-founder and CEO Crystal is here to tell us how Bento Box has grown from side hustle to a flourishing company with thousands of clients. Enjoy our chat.
What was hot and happening on the internet when you graduated from college?
Yeah, I mean, Napster was that whole P2P sharing thing was big. Instant Messenger, like AOL Instant Messenger, even though you weren't on AOL, just like that was kind of like the way that you were communicating. Hotmail, you know, we had Hotmail accounts, not Gmail accounts. Yeah, those were kind of like the main highlights I remember.
And then how did you start working with restaurants?
After working at a few agencies, I was like, I'm going to work for myself. I'm going to be a freelancer. I'm going to start like a mini agency with a bunch of different freelancers together and worked with different kinds of clients from fashion. Like worked with Marc Jacobs. I worked with some liquor brands, Sailor Jerry's Rum. And then I was through a friend, I think on a high school friend, I got connected to, it was actually Momofuku was one of the first restaurant websites I ever worked on way back in the day. It was like 2012. And they were looking for a web designer and I knew how to make websites. So started on that. It was just kind of serendipitous that I got to work on it. And then subsequently worked with the Breslin on their website and then got a call from the meatball shop. And so when I was working with the Breslin and the meatball shop, it was just like, okay, well, there's a real common theme here in terms of what restaurants are looking for online. There's a kind of common frustration about wanting to use their website to do more than historically it would do because there were different technologies popping up like Yelp and OpenTable, and they felt they were kind of like losing control with technology and their website was the way to get it back. And I was having a hard time giving them exactly what they needed through Squarespace or WordPress. And it was just very costly to set something up like exactly what they wanted.
I remember I had a restaurant back then and I remember what it cost to hire someone to build a website. I mean, yeah. It was over $10,000.
Yeah, it was crazy.
For even a very basic website.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was talking to the Breslin and the meatball shop, you know, for that same cost, I could just build something custom that does exactly what you want it to do. And it won't have some of the problems that WordPress had at the time. And they were into it. And they were the first two customers on Bento Box. And that was back in like 2013.
So when did Bento Box become an official company?
It was April 2013.
Okay. Okay. And what happened? The design agency.
there's the design agency that I was running, and I put in quotes, these air quotes I'm doing, because, you know, it was kind of just a one woman show, and I would kind of pull in different people I knew for different parts of it. It was called Neon and Sons, and kind of kept doing that to make money to then put into Bento Box to work with more restaurants. So they kind of like that kind of burned out through 2013, and Bento Box started becoming the main thing.
So when you looked into your crystal ball, no pun intended, what did you see for the future of restaurants and restaurant websites? Because what you were doing and what you saw back then was very different from even pre-pandemic, what was going on in terms of websites.
Yeah, I mean, I think I always saw the opportunity for restaurants to have their piece of like the internet that was theirs and to actually be able to use it in a way that really supported their business. Really, actually, they could make money off of it. What it actually came down to is that like it didn't have to be a cost center. And that was like really important. That underlying idea was pretty clear at that point. Now, like what it was going to turn into wasn't obvious. You know, I couldn't have, you know, said that we were going to get to like where we are today. That like core theme was clear.
What was it that you liked enough about restaurants to want to pivot and focus more exclusively on restaurants?
Well, I think I knew how to solve the problem, and that was important. And I think that I probably, just given my background and my natural kind of problem solving combined with design nature, I probably could have solved it for other industries, I think, like an auto body shop or some other small business, but I just wouldn't have cared as much. So I just cared, and I just thought this was such a cool industry that had given me some of the best experiences of my life and just has played like a really important role. Growing up, I felt like restaurants were a place that it was almost this third place for me and my family that was more about bringing them into my American culture versus I always had to kind of be part of their Persian culture, and just bridging that gap was really tricky. And restaurants were a place that were warm and hospitable and we were like taken care of, but it was in the American world, where otherwise like my only other time where I was in those worlds were like school or sports, that, you know, my parents wouldn't be there with me, obviously. So they just played a really important role in my life and who I was and how I connected with people.
Mm-hmm. And even though that was almost 10 years ago, 2012 was a very hot time in New York City in the restaurant world. And you, it sounds like you were right in the middle of it. You mentioned Momofuku, the Breslin, the meatball shop. Mm-hmm. I mean, those places were all, 2012 was a major year for all of them.
Yeah, got very lucky to have gotten to work with such great restaurants early on, because I don't think Bento Box would not have been what it is today if I hadn't gotten that opportunity. And it was really like luck. Got introduced to the right people. And then, you know, doing right by people too. I think the restaurant industry is obviously one of community and sharing and do good work. And I think it builds a lot of goodwill. And so I think that went really far too.
How did you start to set up the company for growth?
Yeah, I would say it was pretty slow to do that in the beginning. I mean, here are all these companies that go out and they just raise a bunch of money, or, you know, they're able to get things in place to just really start just sprinting towards what they're looking to do without having much to show for it, without having much proven, I should say.
Proof of concept.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a product and I had customers that were in the first year or two, you know, we got 50 to 100 restaurants starting to use the platform. And yeah, it was really tough to get capital behind it, to be able to go faster, to even like actually pay ourselves, like me and my co-founder. We were kind of like, Bento Box had to be kind of on the side because we couldn't dedicate everything to it. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. One was, I do think that historically restaurants have been kind of scary businesses for, you know, anyone that is funding businesses. I think that's changing a lot right now because I think a lot of people see a lot of opportunity, but historically, I think they've been very scary. I didn't really like speak the language. I was a designer. I didn't have a finance background. And it took quite a while for me to learn what the way I needed to be thinking about the business, the way I needed to be thinking about growth, what ROI meant, what all these metrics meant, like why they even mattered. And they do matter, you know, it's not just these fancy words. They actually just, they're real. And it took a while for me to be able to do that. And then just my nature, I'm pretty understated. And I think that we hear a lot about these entrepreneurs that are just so eccentric and outspoken and just have a real big presence. And I just didn't have that. I'm like, hey, I built a platform and some restaurants like to use it and they're paying me for it. So why wouldn't you give me money to grow it more? And I just wasn't as good at the vision casting, but that was very motivating. I really like the idea of becoming good at something I'm not good at. That's a great challenge. And so while it took, just kind of launched in 2013 and then probably got our first real like outside capital in the door in early 2015. So a couple of years.
So you bootstrapped things for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just a lot of like kind of using, doing the side projects with the agency that I was running and stringing things together to try to make it work. And yeah, it was a really, it was tough, but when I look back on it, it was just such a learning period that it doesn't feel tough. If anyone was telling me the story of just trying to make ends meet and trying to work through all this, I would have been like, wow, that sounds really hard. But in the moment, it all had to happen to get to where things are today.
And I think a lot of restaurateurs can, and restaurant owners, chefs, etc., can relate to that. I mean, the number of, like you said, people aren't dying to give restaurants money to open.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the bigger projects, of course, are well funded and capitalized, but smaller restaurants, absolutely not.
Yeah.
I know a lot of our restaurant folks can relate to that feeling,
yeah,
of having to go at it on your own.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities. You have this thing that you love to do when you're opening a restaurant, not having done it before, but there's a lot of passion behind it. And you need to be able to kind of sell on not just your passion and just being your craft, but the vision and like the numbers. And that stuff takes practice.
What was the turning point for Bento Box? When were you able to bring investors on board or capture their attention?
I spent a lot of time, I would talk to a lot of investors, I would pitch a lot of investors, and we were too early, or like I, you know, would get a ton of feedback around like what was missing or what I needed to work on. And I felt like I was kind of always trying to be this person that these people wanted to give money to, like this other person that wasn't me. And I got the advice somewhere along the way that was, you're an amazing designer. You are a great digital product thinker. You should just lean into that. That's what you're good at. That's like what makes you confident. And I think it was really great advice because I felt like things started coming together after that, because I could just focus. I could talk really confidently and speak really confidently about the things I was good at versus trying to just be this other person. And very, I would say, pretty soon after that, we got accepted into this program called TechStars, which is a tech accelerator where they give you a little bit of money. And, you know, they take a significant percentage, but there's a lot of value add that comes with it. And they pick 10 companies and they give like mentorship. And it's kind of like a stamp of approval too in the tech and like VC world. So once that happened, things just kind of started accelerating after that. That was early 2015. And then by the end of 2015, we raised our first seed round, which was $2 million, which is, I would have never, that amount of money sounded like a fake number to me back then.
It's so interesting though, that once you were being your more authentic self, things changed for you.
Yeah. And it feels so obvious, but it's not obvious when you're going through the motions. You just think people are looking for something and you're just trying to perform and be that.
I would imagine, especially in the tech world, and especially in the tech world trying to raise money, you really are expected to go into these rooms and perform.
Yeah.
And be who they want, you think they want you to be. It's funny, when you were talking about all of that, I was thinking design to CEO is not a typical career path,
yeah,
or path to the CEO office. But then I was like, well, there was Steve Jobs,
yeah,
you know, and Steve Jobs was a genius designer and product person. And
yeah, and I think that he probably was really his authentic self from what we've read and what we've seen.
From what I have read, he did not have a problem being his authentic self. Maybe some people would have liked that he was less his authentic self, but that's, I guess, for another podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you finally were successful in raising money, how was Bento Box doing at the time? Had the company become profitable yet? What was the story there?
I mean, things were going really well, I would say, in terms of like raising money is really like a means to an end to be able to like accelerate growth. It was less about getting to profitability, but more about how can we go faster in terms of building product? How can we reach more restaurants? How can we get the right team on board? I mean, I think that we started being able to really build out our product set more, which was important to me. And we were able to start transitioning Bento Box from like just this website platform to how can this actually be like more of the restaurant's digital storefront and their digital property and not be that cost center. And so I remember we first launched gift cards and it was for the holidays and a couple of restaurants started using that. And then we started doing catering, ways to sell catering and the merchandise and tickets.
And this was even before the pandemic.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're in early 2016, I would say, when all of this kind of started being built in to the platform.
And did you have clients across the whole country?
Yeah, yeah, we did. I remember we had a lot in New York to start. We had a bunch in DC. Like I'm from the DC area. And so I knew a couple people there and it just started like slowly kind of spreading out. We got a couple in Florida. I think it was probably by 2018, we had restaurants in all 50 states. So
very cool.
Yeah.
That must've been a nice moment. I mean, you started at such a high level with Momofuku and the Breslin and the meatball shop. Were there any sort of milestones along the way? Were there any restaurants that you signed on that you considered like a personal victory? Either it was a restaurant you loved or a restaurateur you really admired?
Yeah, it's not going to be like a big name one. So hopefully that's okay. But I went to school in Philadelphia and there was this restaurant I would go to there. And that was right in my early, right when I was becoming 21, like old enough to drink. It's when I started really first like appreciating wine. And there was this restaurant there called Tria. It was like a beer, wine, and cheese place. And I was just learning. I'm like, wow, you can have cheese and you can have it with wine. And it just tastes so good together. This is magical. And I was a college student. So like, I didn't have that much money. And on Sundays, they had one wine and one cheese, half off. And so they call it that Sunday school and they would teach you about them. And so anyway, I would say maybe in 2017 or 2018, maybe we signed one of, I saw it, we have like a Slack channel and we sign up new restaurants and I saw it pop up and I was like, no, you know, I couldn't believe it. And yeah, it was that one. And sales rep said something to the restaurant owner about how I was just like probably doing cartwheels in the office. I was so excited. And the owner sent me a note, you know, it's this random restaurant in Philly. And he was like, I heard you were a big fan of Tria and you go there all the time. And I was just like, yeah, I'm so excited. This was such a great moment. But it was a small little victory.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah.
When did you start to notice that 2020 was not going to be business as usual?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it was probably I remember it was a Thursday. We did a practice work from home day just to make sure everyone had their stuff. And just in case, you know, who knows what's going to happen.
Wow.
And then the next day was a Friday and they announced in the city that restaurants were shutting down. And yeah, I think it was just that moment. Like we never went back to the office, like full time. And I was like, wow, this is real.
New York City shuts down and other cities similarly start shutting down. I would have to imagine that for executives in your position in lots of different industries adjacent to restaurants,
yeah,
it was not a great moment.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you're kind of in the position of having to experience this thing that's going on, but then know that like there's 100+ people that are looking to you to tell them everything's going to be okay. And we have a plan and don't worry. And the thing that kind of worked for me and our company and for us was just constant communication and dialogue. Even if the news wasn't going to be good, there was just, we were always going to be honest and we were always going to be like as transparent as we were able to be. And that's kind of like all you can do.
What were you hearing from your restaurant partners back then?
I mean, everyone was really scared. And everyone was, I mean, honestly, everyone was just trying to like find ways to like keep their staff. It was really interesting. I think if I think about what I really remember is everyone was really concerned about their staff and they were just trying to find ways to like accommodate their staff. They're like, okay, well, if I sell a bunch of gift cards today, even though the restaurant's like not going to be open, maybe I can pay my staff for like another week. And I take like my maitre d' and turn them into like a delivery person. And it was a lot. There was just a lot of care for like the people that were at the restaurant. It was like the main message.
It's amazing how restaurants pivoted and the amount of creativity they all brought to the process over the past year. How did Bento Box have to pivot? Or did you even have to pivot? I mean, it seems like you were poised to help them with the things they needed help with.
Yeah. I mean, we made like one really big pivot, which was we had actually just launched online ordering in February, which was crazy, but you had to buy a website to buy online ordering. And so that week we started decoupling the website and online ordering, and everyone worked like day and night. And by the end of the week, we could have like an online ordering product that was just separate and that restaurants could buy it separately. And then we did a bunch of other like little things, like we built in a little COVID relief checkbox, like $199 fee. And we just built in these little things to help, you know, do whatever we can. We paused. I can't even remember how many subscriptions, but anyone that reached out to us, we went ahead and paused their account for however many months. And if they ever asked for more months, we gave them more months. And so did a lot of little things, like you said earlier, in some ways, like we were kind of like ready for this moment in some way. We were just focused on like, how can we just be accessible and available to help restaurants? The funny thing was, is I remember we were doing planning back in 2019 and we were thinking about like, what is our next product? And it was going to be like one of these two big things. It was either going to be reservations or it was going to be online ordering. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't late 2019, it was late 2018 even, because it took us like almost a year to really build it. And we did a lot of analysis on our customer base and decided that we were going to build online ordering.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, what a game-changing decision that we made, not even knowing what the impact was going to be.
And how many restaurants do you work with today?
It's about 7,000.
I mean, that must have been, I don't want to say life-changing, but business-changing for those restaurants to have that option.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, and we just got so many great success stories of people being able to keep their staff on board. I mean, some of the restaurants on our platform have made over 2020, like millions of dollars through online ordering, like direct, but no fees have been taken off. But I mean, it's not an insignificant amount of money. And the restaurants I'm even talking about, a lot of them are not in New York City. They're in other parts of the country. And so I think that as a restaurateur, if you were able to really think about your business in a different way, and we're willing to, like, it's not the right decision for every restaurant. Mm-hmm. I think you could have really done well.
So explain to me how Bento Box makes money from the online ordering. So you're not charging a fee similar to like a DoorDash or a Caviar.
Yeah, we don't do like a commission fee that the restaurant pays. We have a 99-cent fee that the diner pays. And I think it's a pretty small price to pay from the diner side when you're used to actually getting like so many more fees, even from the like service fees or whatever they are from all the marketplaces. Yeah. And it helps us make sure like 100% goes to the restaurant.
What is your take on the state of things for US restaurants?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I don't think we're out of the woods yet, obviously. And I think that there are a lot of after effects, what we're hearing with staffing and just like the restaurant industry is like completely changed. There's still a lot of adapting that needs to happen. So I do think that we're not in the clear yet, but I do believe that there has been like a really interesting and powerful, and I think net like positive change in the restaurant industry, where restaurants have, because they wanted to continue to serve their communities, needed to think of themselves outside of like what they provide, the meal and the brick and mortar. And they were like forced, and they have so much more to offer, you know, and they were forced to do that. And I do think that by diversifying their businesses and becoming almost more like lifestyle brands and not just restaurants in some way, and like offering groceries or like virtual classes or merchandise or like, you know, meal kits or whatever it is that they did, these are like real revenue streams that are like pretty high margin. I do think that restaurants can like emerge as stronger businesses on the other side of this. as they embrace and adopt these different ways of like running their business. And again, I don't think it's for every restaurant. I think we all like read that like amazing op-ed, the prune one, that was just like so heartbreaking. And you can choose to have a restaurant that is a certain way, or you can choose to have it a different way. Both of those are great ways to run a business. I think that like there's this opportunity to really for restaurants to really go beyond what they've been doing. And I do think the effects are going to be really positive.
Back to the money part again. You, when was it, October, raised $28.8 million as part of your Series C.
Yeah.
What was the intention with that round of fundraising? What are you hoping to do next with Bento Box?
Yeah, I mean, a big part of it was growing our team. I've been really focused on building an executive team. Like I think we have like a huge opportunity ahead of us, and we have had an amazing team of like people that are just working really hard and like figuring it out on the go, including myself. And we, since we raised that round, been focused on bringing in some experience to like help us in this new phase of growth. And honestly, what that does is it allows us to, and me to focus on like the areas that I like focusing on, you know, most. So that's been a big part of it. And then on the product side, I think that there's this huge opportunity right now as digital payments and digital commerce has become a bigger part of restaurants to really think of that more holistically. And what I mean by that is that like an online payment and like an on-premise payment shouldn't be two different things. One shouldn't be a swipe while another one is not. And we're really thinking about how do we bring those two things together and how do we help restaurants in that have like a more complete idea of who their guest or their diner is, because you have a relationship with them online and offline, and it's just much more deep and fulfilling, and you can have a bigger impact in their lives than just when they're sitting at the restaurant.
As Bento Box grows, how do you avoid becoming a brand that restaurants don't feel like they have a partnership with anymore? You know, you look at what's happened with these third-party delivery companies,
yeah,
or a Yelp. They are not viewed as entities that are looking to help restaurants,
yeah,
more that are preying on their vulnerabilities and their tech inabilities.
Yeah.
What are you doing to make sure Bento Box doesn't fall into that one day?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's really simple. And all of those businesses, I think the thing that they have in common is that they have businesses like restaurants as their customers, and they have consumers as their customers, and they have their own brand as well. Bento Box, the customer is always the restaurant, no matter what. There's never going to be a Bento Box marketplace or a Bento Box brand. The Bento Box brand is invisible, in my opinion. It's only there to serve the restaurant's brand, to bolster the restaurant's brand. And so that just aligns, you know, goals so much easier. And that there isn't this like push and pull between like who the business is actually serving. And I think that's just the one defining thing that kind of goes wrong when you think about all of these like third parties.
Thank you so much to Crystal Mobieni for joining me. If you'd like to learn more about Bento Box, visit getbento.com. Right after the break, I will be back with Julia Joseph of Maple Hill Creamery. I am very excited to tell you about another podcast that I think you'll really enjoy. It's called Schmaltzy, and it's a storytelling podcast about food, identity, and everything in between from our friends at the Jewish Food Society. Each episode features a personal story told by a celebrity chef, a grandmother, cookbook author, or entrepreneur, followed by a wonderful conversation with the storyteller and host Amanda Dell. Schmaltzy has featured some of our favorite folks, including Zoe Kanaan, Liz Alpern, and Amber Ahmad, and this week, cookbook author Adina Sussman shares a story about growing up in Palo Alto, California, with an unusual addition in her family's garage, a kosher cheese shop. Silicon Valley has seen a lot of startups founded in garages, but nothing like this one. What I love about Schmaltzy is how it illustrates the unique power of storytelling to unite us even when we are far apart. You can find Schmaltzy wherever you get your podcasts. And, as promised, here's a clip from Adina's episode.
And then there were those Chuck E. Cheese birthday parties of my youth, which for me were pure sheer torture. While everybody else was eating this delicious smelling and looking pizza, I had a different menu for the party. It was the tuna on wheat that my mom had prepared for me and wrapped in a little plastic sandwich baggie. And I think I even knew back then that I didn't want to separate myself from the world when it came to food. I really wanted to connect with other people and explore one bite at a time. Now, a lot of the differences that my family had centered around food and around kosher cheese for some reason. We didn't eat unkosher cheese because it contained animal rennet. And the few Orthodox Jews in Palo Alto and those around Northern California really wanted this product, but it was something that they had a really hard time getting their hands on. So my dad somehow became a bi-coastal pack mule. Every time he would go to New York on a business trip, he would load up his giant leather suitcase with kosher cheese, and he'd drag it all the way across the country. And mind you, this was long before the days of roller bag suitcases. So one day in the airport, disaster struck, and my dad was pulling the luggage off of the carousel, and the entire suitcase busted open on the floor of San Francisco International Airport. Cheese went tumbling everywhere, and the DEA agents came right over to my dad, and they were convinced that there was something far more nefarious in that suitcase than cheese. So my dad showed up at home later that night. He looked at my mom. He threw the suitcase on the floor, and he said, "That's it, Steffi. I'm done. No more schlepping."
Would you like to hear the rest? Of course you would. You can catch the entire Schmaltzy episode with Adina wherever you get your podcasts or at jewishfoodsociety.org/podcasts. Now, here's my interview with Julia Joseph, one of the founders of Maple Hill Creamery, the 100% grass-fed organic dairy that has grown from one farm on the verge of collapse to more than 150 small family farms. Maple Hill Creamery is committed to regenerative agriculture and doing right by their customers, their farmers, their cows, and the environment. We'll hear how the team weathered the pandemic and the increased demand for milk, and how they stepped in with product donations to help those in need, including some friends of Cherry Bombs. You might not think cows when you think startups, but you will soon. Enjoy my interview with Julia Joseph.
Let's start with just what's going on right now. How has the past year been with the pandemic?
So, you know, it's been trying for all of us, but, you know, as we're a dairy brand and we are staple within homes, right? People's refrigerators or grocery lists. We were coming out okay at the end, but we also have a responsibility to help others during this trying time. Right off the bat, as soon as, you know, the epicenter of the pandemic hit, which is in our area, New York City and Westchester, we worked with food banks and Feed America to do donations. Tractor trailers of our product every week went down. I think we've donated over 100 tons for sure of dairy at this point, and we continue to do so. You know, that's a responsibility we have as a brand.
Yeah, you very kindly donated to the Food and Finance High School and the Food Education Fund in the spring. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, we are happy to do it. It's such a great school and program. So thank you for asking and bringing it to our attention.
Tell us what your job is. You wear many hats at Maple Hill. Tell us what you do officially.
In the beginning, we did it all of us. We wore the hats, you know, counting, cleaning toilets, doing marketing, putting fences up. I mean, across the board. But the last couple of years, we've been in business 11 years. So the last 3-4 years, I've been able to really focus on what I love to do within the company. And so I'm the head of creative. What you see on shelf is my baby. I'm really proud of our packaging. I'm really proud of our brand voice and tone. I'm also the spokeswoman, more public facing for our company. I believe in what our pillars are at Maple Hill, and I live that. You know, I make my choices around the pillars that we built with Maple Hill, which is transparent, traceable, sustainable, regenerative, humane to animals, living healthy, making the right food choices, low sugar. These are all things that I live every single day.
When everything started to go down back in March of 2020, how did you react as a company?
Well, we all paused, right? Just like everyone paused. There were so many unknowns. We really weren't sure what was going to happen. We, of course, were concerned for our farmers. They're always number one. We, of course, were concerned about you know, what's going to happen to the economy during all of this and the sales. And like I said, we were very fortunate. We offer a really great high quality product, and this is what people wanted. They wanted to feel good about what they were buying during this pandemic of, you know, so many limitations. So they're making choices, and they made a choice to buy the best quality milk you can get. And that's Maple Hill. So we were really fortunate there. Our company functions, you know, at the company level for our office, we were already like 50% remote and then 50% in an office. So there wasn't much of a...
That was prior to the pandemic.
Yeah. So there wasn't much of a blip. We all sort of knew how to function through email and some Zoom. I mean, Zoom obviously wasn't as widely used as it is now.
So tell us about the history of Maple Hill. How did this company even come about?
Well, Tim and Laura, Tim's my brother, Laura's my sister-in-law, they purchased a farm, a conventional farm, believe it or not, in upstate New York, Western New York, and they had never farmed before, but Tim was definitely born in the wrong era. He was working for a larger corporation, and he was a director there, and he said, I really just want to do something different. So we did both at the same time, and it was definitely a learning curve. He had never farmed. We had like a hobby. We had like a homestead kind of farm. We lived on 20 acres. We had horses, chickens, donkeys, but not one cow. So we had no experience. So Tim and Laura purchased the farm, and they knew they wanted to transition to organic. So they started transitioning to organic. And when you purchase a farm, there's so much financial burden on top of your shoulders. Any farm, doesn't matter. Any farm, you have the financial burden. So they had that going, and then they wanted to transition to organic, which was what they wanted to do, but then that added more heavy weight onto their shoulders financially, because when you transition, there's a transition period for your price of milk. So you're doing a higher input cost, which is corn and grain. And at that time they were feeding corn and grain because that's what everyone told them to do. It was like unheard of to feed the cows grass ever. So they ended up making that transition, and it got worse. It was just so heavy, you know, to feed their cows corn and grain that was organic. They already had layers, and then they added another layer. So they knew they wanted to go to grass-fed organic at one point, right? But it was by default. They couldn't afford the corn and grain bill. So they had enough acreage to farm all of their cows grass-fed organic. And once they made that transition, first there was no market for that milk whatsoever, right? But they still made that transition because they wanted to survive. They wanted to feed their cows and be able to keep their farm. And once they made the transition, they realized how much healthier their cows were and how much healthier their land was. It was like they knew that these were the benefits, but then they actually witnessed it. So that happened. And then in 2000, we all know what happened in 2008, right? A bubble burst. And that means the milk prices dropped even more. And milk prices were not great. So then Tim was, you know, thinking of a more creative way to get the revenue back. And so he ended up saying, let's create a yogurt, because it was easy. Let's create a yogurt and sell it at a farm stand. And the farm stand was on part of the farm. During that time, probably 3 months in of starting that, I started going up and helping him every weekend. I would drive 3 hours from New Jersey and then 3 hours back.
Tell us what you were doing at the time. You were not involved in farming. You were not involved in, you weren't a farmer. You didn't make products, none of that.
No. I mean, I was a bit of a country girl, you know, like, you know, you think of New Jersey, you don't think there's beautiful rolling hills or anything, but it's a beautiful area where I grew up. So I was fortunate to grow up on a small hobby farm and really enjoy the outdoors. But like, I had no clue about a dairy farm. And so I was running my dad's businesses down in New Jersey for about 16 years, which was commercial building, real estate. I ran his business for 16 years of custom framing and a high-end art gallery. I mean, not even close to where I landed. And again, I wasn't planning on landing up at Maple Hill at all. So I was able to take 3 days weekends and go up and help. And, you know, Tim and Laura at the time had 4 kids. Now they have 5. So you can imagine the complete insanity that happens on a farm plus 5 kids and then running a creamery and then the farm. So I ended up at Maple Hill after 3 months. It was the same month that my grandma had passed away. It was in 2009. And I remember I was in the church in Brooklyn. That's where she was born and raised. So we had her funeral there, and I was in the church, and my spouse at the time, Pete, was on one side and Tim was on the other, my brother. And I had this urgency and clarity and calmness come over me, and anxiety all at the same time. And I knew at that time we had to help Tim. It was just like, it was falling apart. There weren't enough hands. There wasn't enough money. It was a mess, you know? And it's not that they made it a mess. It's just farming in general and startups are crazy. At the church, I said to myself, we need to make a change. And so I waited till the evening when we were done through the day. And I talked to Pete and I said, you know, Pete, I think we should go up and help Tim. And he said, without a skip, okay. And so and this is very rare for me because I don't like change. I am a Virgo through and through, like systems. I like consistency. So the fact that I was able to make that choice and a huge leap from one life to another, like a life that is totally extreme opposite of what I was used to, it said something. There was something else happening there spiritually, I feel like. I think it was my grandma basically saying, you got to help, to a Brooklyn accent, you got to help your brother. You can't let him fall. So I really, truly feel like she had something to do with it.
Wow.
And so we ended up going up. I wrapped up our life. We sold everything. Pete went up for a year without me. I'd go up every weekend still and help and work. And then I made the full move. And then we didn't think, again, let's backtrack. We did not think that we were going up to build a brand like we have now.
Wow. It's amazing. But things got worse before they got better, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was bad when we got up there financially, really bad. Just day to day, two fires that would just be starting. We have to just put them out. It was really tough. Every single day was a challenge. Look back on how we got where we're at today. And it's like, I feel like I've blocked a lot of it out. But when I sit down and talk with you or anybody else, I go through the memories. And I'm like, oh my God, how did we do this? You know, you're managing the farm. I mean, in the beginning we did it all. We didn't have a staff like we have now or a company that we had now. We would be milking and then we would have to make the products after we were done milking. And then, you know, cows get out, you got to chase the cows. And then there was accounting and marketing that was neglected. So I took that on. And then there was just cleaning, you know, and then making dinners, mowing the lawn. It was just insane.
Now, none of you came from a product background. Yeah. So how did you even know to start a brand, to figure out the marketing, the product design, product development, all of that? You're shaking your head.
Now, none of us had any idea. There was no business plan either in the beginning of this. It was just supposed to be a small farm stand. And then it started going regionally. And then we started to get into New York City. And then that rolled everything out and kept us going, still threw us under, you know, heavy financial burden because we were growing so fast. But that was a learning curve right there. I mean, you think when you're growing, we would grow 100%, 200%, 300%, 400%, like each year. It was insane. But, you know, you don't realize you have no cash when that happens. So there was so much that we had to learn just blindly going through. I mean, from figuring out how to do UPC codes, from building a website to, you know, federal regulation for dairy and distributing in different regions. I mean, you name it, it was all new and we all did it together. We all just landed where we were supposed to be, our strengths and weaknesses, and we seemed to all bond together and get through each day.
Why didn't anyone give up?
There was no way we were going to give up because it wasn't just our family that was relying on this. It was actually Tim and Laura, you know, like it wasn't just for them. After two years, we ended up adding more farms, and they were small family farms, and they were 100% grass-fed organic. They were just as crazy as we were to do grass-fed organic in a conventional world. So they took a risk and they jumped off the milk truck, which is crazy to do for a startup, but they knew we had the same core beliefs. You know, it wasn't just us. If we gave up and we failed, we had 3-4 years in, we had 100 small family farms. And so we would have been giving up on them. So there was no way that was going to happen. No way.
What was the turning point, Julia?
There were a bunch of turning points. I mean, there were a bunch of pivotal moments. I distinctly remember one. It was way in the beginning after, it was like a year after we had joined Maple Hill, and it happened in Brooklyn again, which is bizarre. It was under the Brooklyn Bridge, and there was a green market that was just a seasonal green market once a month, September to December. And I mean, Tim was ready to lose the farm. And this was before we had like a bunch of farms. We had like two local farms with us and two or three. And we were like, this is it. Like, we got to do this. If we don't, this is like, we did it to try to save the creamery and save the farm. And so we went down, we pooled as much money as we could. Our two sisters had nothing to do with the business, came and helped us. We ended up getting our first distributor under the Brooklyn Bridge, and that got us into New York City, like into Park Slope, all the great co-ops. That really set the stage for Maple Hill and where we were going to go. And it just snowballed from there. Just being on New York City shelves got us into larger distribution regions. So we then went to Midwest, and then it's crazy, but we ended up going to California because there was a distributor that said we could do this for you. And then we ended up closing into the center eventually, and now we're national.
Wow. Did you have to raise money at any point?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Just like any startup, there's, you know, a bunch of series and you go through investments. It's investors. It's a tough process for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, in order to keep growing, like I mentioned, we were growing so fast. There was no cash, nothing, but we somehow did it. But I don't think we could have gotten where we're at today if there wasn't the influx of funds.
So not only all this, but you're really betting so heavily on grass-fed, because I enjoy going to supermarkets and looking at product, and, you know, both personally and professionally. And I didn't see other grass-fed brands. Like, you were it in New York.
Maple Hill created the category, really.
For milk, you created the category.
We created the category, the price point for farmers to get paid what they deserve for their grass-fed organic farming, above organic pricing. So we created that nationwide, which is pretty crazy. Also for consumers, when 2009 came out, it was like unheard of. It was like grass-fed beef was, you know, the buzzword and starting to get more understood and more in the
I think my first exposure was to grass-fed beef, and then Kerrygold, who, you know we work with them a lot, and their grass-fed butter. And then I hadn't seen another grass-fed yogurt or milk brand until I started to notice you on the shelves.
Yeah, we definitely were the disruptors.
Now, I was somewhere outside New York, and I saw, we don't have to name names, but I saw another milk company that was selling grass-fed milk, and their product, the packaging was such a ripoff of your packaging. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. So now you have to deal with competition.
Yeah. Actually, we take it as a compliment. If you're getting it's a copycat, we'll take it as a compliment. But you know, it's okay. We want to have more options out there that are grass-fed organic, because consumers will understand it more when you're not just the one product on the shelf.
The competition is good because it brings more understanding of what grass-fed is, but all milk brands should be grass-fed.
Correct.
For the environment, for people's health, all of that.
They should, absolutely. But that takes, and I hope that we can get there someday, absolutely. But it's going to take a lot of time. Like I mentioned earlier, our soils are done. You know, there's not enough healthy soil, and just farming in general is just, again, so financially heavy. Mm-hmm. Conventional farming and industrialist farming, that these farmers can't make a transition like that. First, they don't have the lands, because their farms have been in the family for probably centuries, right? So they don't have the land to be a grass-fed organic farm. And if they do, the transition is so painful financially that they may not survive it. And that goes back to, maybe we need to talk about this more with legislation, agricultural legislation, because if we're as a whole, I mean, not everybody is interested in this, but as a whole, if we want to save our environment and bring our soils back to life, we have to offer something to these farmers to fill the gap in their transition, or they're not going to make it. So what we did is, you know, when there's a transition from organic to grass-fed, we filled that gap for our farmers by giving them a higher price point so they can survive to that 2-year mark, so that their cows can transition, their land, even their fence posts, everything has to transition to organic and then grass-fed. So we tried to do that on a small scale within our company. But this is a much bigger discussion across the whole agricultural industry. When we talk about other farms and conventional industrialized farming, I always like to say a lot of these farmers didn't have a choice, right? So we're not attacking the farmers. It's the practice of the farming. And I want to make that very clear because we know how hard farming can be. No matter what practice you're in, it's very hard. So, you know, what we need to do is we need to support one another farm to farm and help figure out how we can make this shift for other farmers who may want to make that shift. It's really important just to bring that to the forefront. And that's not just on us. It's on, like I mentioned, legislation and government too. So. Mm-hmm.
Right. And how consumers spend their dollars. I think that has been such a proponent of change on so many levels. When you go to the supermarket, do your homework and try to buy these brands that are doing better and support your local farmers markets. I mean, that's where Maple Hill started out. I think that might've been the first place I saw you. Was it the Union Square Farmers Market? Were you there?
You know, what year was that? Because we had a distributor.
Back when you had the old packaging.
Oh, really old. Yeah, I think we had a distributor who would bring it down.
Okay.
Sell it for us.
Because I distinctly, or maybe I saw it somewhere else, but I distinctly remember that, the old yogurt packaging.
Great. There's no way we could have gotten it together to actually go every weekend to the city and do that. So that's why we could only do that one market.
I must have seen it somewhere else. But anyway, you know, to everybody listening, I know we have a wonderful audience and they really do think about things like this. But be mindful when you go to the supermarket and support your farmers at your farmers markets, however you can.
Yes, absolutely.
So important. So, Julia, I guess I just have one more question. When you look at how different your life is today and what it was a decade or two ago, what goes through your mind? I mean, you've had such a journey.
I can't imagine where I was 12 years ago, because around 11 years, I never thought I'd be where I'm at today, co-founding a national distributed dairy brands and being able to feel really proud. And it's very rewarding to have a company like this. I mean, I'm not just the co-founder of Maple Hill, but I'm a certified Pilates teacher. So during that time, when I found a moment 2 or 3 years ago, I was able to get certified. And so I get to live a very rewarding life. And I feel very fortunate about that. We offer an amazing product. We help farmers every day. That's so rewarding. Like, that's number one. And then I get to teach at a smaller scale and help people turn their head an extra inch or build their core up and feel really good about it and just have better mobility. You know, so everything that I've come to at this point, I feel so fortunate.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much to Julia Joseph of Maple Hill Creamery for sharing her story and for making such beautiful products. Like my favorite, their grass-fed organic Greek yogurt. It's good stuff. Look for Maple Hill products at Whole Foods Market, and you can learn more at maplehill.com. Thank you also to Crystal Mobieni, and special thanks to today's partner, Schmaltzy, the podcast from the Jewish Food Society. Radio Cherry Bomb is produced by Cherry Bomb Media. Today's show is engineered and edited by Jenna Sadu. Jenna, you are the bomb. You know who else is the bomb? You are. Thank you for listening.
I'll have what she's having.